Shotcast, venting steam throughout the cosmos. Megan Argo, George Bennett, John Hughes, Stuart Harper, Indy LaBerk, Ian Morrison, and Chris Wallace. The Jodcast, February 2014 edition. Hello and welcome to Jodcast. I'm joined today by Megan Argo and Indy LaBerk.
Hi.
Hello.
And the show this time, Chris Wallace interviews Dr. Chris Messenger about gravitational waves. Ian Morrison and John Field take a look at what's happening in the February night sky. And we bring you some astronomical odds and ends. But first, before all of that, here's Stuart with this month's news.
This month in the news, Hurricane Lumen. Brown dwarfs are an unusual sort of star. During their early development, they failed to accumulate enough bulk to ignite fusion in their cores, resulting in them being small, dull, and notoriously difficult to find or study. Thought to share more in common with gas giant planets like Jupiter or Saturn than the Sun, brown dwarfs occupy a middle ground in the cosmic zoo, which is what makes them such interesting objects to study. The atmospheres of gas giants are turbulent places. They are racked by constant storms and ferocious winds that result in the impressive bands of colour which wrap around Jupiter, or the form the perpetual hurricane seen by Cassini at the north pole of Saturn. This begs the question, do brown dwarfs have extreme storms raging across their surfaces too? They are, after all, effectively just supersized gas giants. This is a question that has been wandering through the minds of astronomers since brown dwarfs were first theorized in the late 1960s. Unfortunately, attempting to answer the question is not an easy task, since brown dwarfs are far too small to actually be resolved by a telescope, and, as mentioned, even discovering them is a challenge. This is reflected by the fact that only 2,000 brown dwarfs have ever been discovered. It was not until just a few years ago, in 2009, that the first ever tentative hint that brown dwarfs are not just static was observed. The observations focused on one particular brown dwarf, which they saw to be shifting in brightness by as much as 10% over timescales of just a few hours. The same amount of time it was expected for a brown dwarf to do a complete full revolution. No one could be sure what was causing the shift in brightness, but it was certainly considered a possibility that it was the result of thick clouds forming and shrouding the inner core of the star, which, if true, would mean that the brown dwarf atmospheres are at least as complex as their gas giant cousins. Last month, astronomers observing the newly discovered and nearby brown dwarf binary pair, Lumen 16A and B, published results that seem to have confirmed finally that brown dwarfs do have stormy atmospheres. Their observations, mostly of Lumen 16b, have mapped out the surface of the star, revealing in detail the large, dark and bright regions which they have attributed to be most likely caused by large clouds. Mapping the surface of Lumen 16b required the utilization of a slightly abstract method that would allow the observers to overcome the difficulty that brown dwarfs are too small and distant to be resolved by any direct observations by a telescope. The observations were made using the CryRes spectrometer on the VLT. By using a spectrometer to observe Lumen 16b, the astronomers exploited the Doppler effect, which allowed them to distinguish between the light from the approaching and receding edge of the star. If the star was featureless, with no weather systems present, we do expect the two sides of Lumen 16b to be equal in brightness, but they were not. The astronomers measured differences in brightness between each side of Lumen 16b and were able to build up an image of the star's surface. This technique has been used before to study brighter stars, but this is the first application of it to a brown dwarf. The hope is that in the future, further observations will be made which will reveal how the weather systems around Lumen 16b change over time. There is even the possibility that this technique could be used to reveal bands around the brown dwarf if high-resolution observations are made, further cementing the link between gas giants and brown dwarfs. The hope is that one day we will be able to understand and even forecast the weather around Lumen 16b, and that such research can be applied to our models of gas giants, aiding in our understanding of their atmospheres and formation.
Thanks for that, Stuart. Now we have Chris Wallace interviewing Dr. Chris Messenger about gravitational waves.
Today on the Jogcast, we have Dr. Chris Messenger from the University of Glasgow. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So you came today and you talked to us about detecting gravitational waves.
Yep.
Would you start by explaining what a gravitational wave is?
So gravitational waves are a consequence of general relativity. They are sort of ripples in space-time propagating through the universe at the speed of light, and they impart tidal forces on freely falling masses. Now, that's a little bit technical, but they basically squish and stretch things when they pass through, or at least they try to.
Okay, and so how do you go about detecting these kind of squishes and stretches of space then?
So the current state-of-the-art technology for doing this is through interferometry. So you set up a laser and you fire it towards a beam splitter, and you send one arm of the laser light straight forward and one arm at 90 degrees. They go off for kilometers in length, bounce off a mirror, and come straight back. They come back to the same beam splitter and then get output to a detection port. You're detecting the light that comes out, and if a gravitational wave came through, it may well have changed the length of the arms of those detectors by squishing and stretching or moving the mirrors, and then you can detect that through the combination of the laser light at the end.
Okay, so what kind of sizes are you looking for to try and detect? What are these shifts? How big are these shifts?
These shifts are incredibly tiny. These are the actual physical shift that you might get over that length, over a 4 kilometers long interferometer, is around 10 to the minus 18 meters, which is the thousandth of the nucleus of an atom. It's amazing that they can detect these things. Although we haven't detected them, but it's amazing that they hope to and plan to detect these.
Okay, so what kind of sources are you looking for? Like, what produces these gravitational waves that you're looking for?
So, fortunately or unfortunately, we have to rely on astrophysical objects to produce these. So we really need very, very high densities and velocities. And unfortunately, if they're astrophysical, that comes with very, very large distances. Hence, we get very, very weak signals. But in needing these very, very dense objects, that means we need black holes, neutron stars, supernova, things like that.
Okay, and what do you expect? What kind of events do you then expect to be able to detect?
So specifically, I mean, our flagship expected source that we expect to detect in the next 5 years is binary neutron stars. So systems containing two neutron stars that are in orbit around each other, emitting gravitational waves, losing energy from the system, getting closer together, going faster around each other, going on like that until they finally get to very high frequency and merge into a black hole.
Okay. So what do you expect to be able to actually gain from detection of this? I mean, is it just the surprising that they're going to merge? Is it the kind of fact that you're detecting a gravitational wave, or what is it about detecting a gravitational wave that is the whole driving force of doing it?
Okay, there's two sides to this. I mean, and one side, you can kind of get blinded with the immediacy and the short-term gains of simply detecting gravitational waves. It would be the first time anyone has directly detected gravitational waves, and that in itself would be amazing. But that's not particularly forward-looking and scientific, what we're going to learn from that. But the thing is, these objects, we will be seeing them in a completely different spectrum. It's not part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's not, you know, we've had optical X-ray, UV, infrared, gamma ray, X-ray, so forth. This is off that spectrum. It has its own spectrum. We just don't know what that spectrum holds. We have some ideas of what things to expect, like these binary neutron stars and binary black holes, but there could well be other things that we have no idea about. And that's what's truly exciting about learning new things about the universe. Also, once you've seen one, two, three, a population of binary neutron stars and binary black holes, it tells us a hell of a lot. It tells us a lot about the population of those objects in the universe and how they formed and how they evolve and how they relate to other types of stars and things like that. So there's a lot of astrophysics in there.
Okay, so one of the main gains is to try and find out about neutron stars then. What do you hope to be able to gain about neutron stars?
So neutron stars specifically, in doing this this inspiraling and merging, you're destroying the neutron stars. So in one scenario, two neutron stars will inspiral and merge and very briefly form a hypermassive neutron star, which is too heavy to support itself, and then it will collapse into a black hole. And the waveform that we get from gravitational waves will tell us very, very specific information about the composition of neutron stars. So we'll be learning about the internal dynamics and matter inside that neutron star.
Okay. You say you said in your talk that we haven't detected them so far. But you did mention a blind detection. Well, could you tell the story for our listeners? Because I think that's pretty funny.
Okay. So it was decided within the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, the international collaboration that I'm part of for trying to detect gravitational waves, that they would have some people that were in charge of artificially injecting a signal into our data in what was called our sixth science run in 2010, I think. And it was quite specific in the sense that there was going to be one or two or possibly three signals injected or zero signals injected. There's always the possibility of none. And it was drawn randomly, and there was only a handful of people that knew about it, and somebody was in charge of artificially putting this signal into the data and directly into the interferometer, not in software afterwards, actually hardware, moving the mirrors via the mechanisms that they've developed for doing this. And as I say, it was only known to a few people, but it was known to the entire collaboration that there was the possibility of this. Hence, when we did our run and analysis of the sixth science data, lo and behold, there was a signal in the data. And what it's funny how people's brains work, because everyone's very excited about detecting gravitational waves. That's why they're doing it. But they're also statistically biased in the fact they know there's the possibility of there being a blind injection. So there was a kind of muted excitement about this thing. Everybody kind of knew it may well be a blind injection, but there was still this underlying excitement about it. And it was decided from the very beginning, when this challenge was put forward, that they would take this to the end. The collaboration would go through as if it was a real signal, do all the analysis, do all the checks, write a paper. The paper was written, vetted by the whole collaboration, went back and forth through many iterations, and was made exactly ready to be submitted to a journal. And it was made, and it was timed perfectly for a LIGO collaboration meeting, LIGO-Virgo collaboration meeting, where there was a vote, that everybody in the collaboration had to vote whether we were going to submit the paper, if it turned out to be a real signal. And the vote was unanimous, I think, or nearly unanimous, that we would publish the paper, or submit it at least. And then the envelope was opened that contained the truth about whether it was an injection or not. And unfortunately, for us and the field, it wasn't a signal. It was a fake injection that was put in.
That must have been very disappointing.
I wasn't directly involved at the time, but my colleagues were, and I wasn't at the meeting. I was watching through Evo over the internet, and everybody seemed to be having a good time, and there was champagne all around, irrespective of the fact that it was a detection or a non-detection. But what it really did teach everybody was that we were ready to detect a gravitational wave. And the whole collaboration, I think, learned a lot in that process.
So why is there a historical reason why people are so nervous about saying that they've detected gravitational waves when they haven't?
I think so. I think that there is a history back in the very early days of gravitational wave detection where bar detectors, there were claims of detection, which were then later proved to not be true. But it's incredibly hard to validate gravitational wave detection even now. And back then, I imagine it was even harder. And I think people are possibly have that stigma associated. We have that stigma associated with us. And I think it's good. It makes us extra safe. We're not just going to throw out a detection claim when there isn't one.
Okay. So you went on in your talk to say how in the future you expect many detections, even though at the moment you've got none. why are you so confident?
So, again, not my field of expertise, but the people that do this, the scientists that do simulations and population synthesis models and taking into account the observational data of some of the objects we're looking for, you put all that together and you end up with a very large error bar on how many of these things we expect to see, or how many of these things exist.
These neutron stars.
Or binary black holes, compact binary coalescences, mm-hmm. or systems that are going to end their life like that in a detectable region around around Earth, right, around our solar system, our galaxy, in fact. And they have these three or four orders of magnitude error bar on this rate. Now we've been slowly creeping up towards that sensitivity, and as of initial LIGO, we were only one order of magnitude away, in the binary neutron star case, from the lower edge of that range. And with advanced detectors, we will be right in the middle, if not near the upper edge of that detection range. And so, all I would say is, I mean, we're guaranteed to detect. It's a statistical thing, but it's very much in our favor.
Mm-hmm.
And we're reliant on the astronomers and the neutron star theorists and the population synthesis people to tell us these numbers.
Okay, so you're quietly confident that something may happen in the future. And when you get those detections, what do you hope to do with it? What's the kind of...
So there's a number of things I would like to do. I mean, one of the main things, the thing I talked about in my seminar, one of my areas of interest is starting to do basic cosmology with gravitational wave detectors. We are seeing out to locally a cosmology at redshifts of about 0.05 for binary neutron stars, or we hope to for advanced detectors. And this gives us a probe for for measuring the Hubble constant, the very first thing we would want to do with gravitational wave observations.
So let's just backpedal a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Firstly, what is the Hubble constant?
Okay. Hubble constant is basically saying how fast the universe is expanding. Certainly locally, it's telling us if we found a galaxy a certain distance away, we would find that it's receding from us. And if we go twice as far away and find another galaxy, we would expect to see it receding at twice the velocity. There's a proportionality there. The further you go out, the faster things are moving away from us. Now, if you go to really high redshifts, that's not a linear relationship anymore, and it starts to be a bit more complicated. But at local distances in our universe, that relation holds. And if we start measuring the distances to these objects, we can make measurements of this Hubble constant.
Yeah, so by knowing the distance and the redshift.
Yeah.
And the redshift. Okay, and what about, you mentioned combinations with electromagnetic radiation. What would be the aim of the collaboration to combine with electromagnetic emission?
So one of the hot topics at the moment, and we're within the collaboration, because we have to get ready for this, is that we would love to have it's basically multi-messenger astronomy. We want to see coincident gravitational wave detection with electromagnetic observation of the same event. And one particular example, specific example of this, is binary neutron stars again, where we expect gamma ray bursts to be caused by binary neutron star mergers. So all the population of gamma ray bursts that have been seen, that's what we expect has happened. Two neutron stars have inspiraled, merged, and emitted this EM burst. And what we would love to do is be able to observe in advanced LIGO a binary neutron star merger, and be able to, within minutes, we want to be able to identify that as a possible detection and send out an alert to other astronomers around the globe and have them quickly point their telescopes to that area of the sky and see if they can either see the GRB or if they can see other optical or other electromagnetic observations from that object in the sky, from that event. And that would lend a lot of statistical weight to the fact that we've detected gravitational waves, but also it's got a lot of rich physics there, because it would then validate the fact, if we saw a GRB in coincidence with a gravitational wave, it would validate the fact that definitely GRBs come from those things, which is currently sort of a theory at the moment, which is strongly believed, but be great to validate it.
Sounds very interesting. What is the kind of wider aim of the field? Because gravitational wave astronomy seems to kind of be blossoming in various ways. What's the wider aim in terms of like the ultimate future?
So, I mean, you mentioned blossoming in different ways, and I mean, one example here at Manchester is pulsar timing, which is looking for gravitational waves using a completely different tool and looking in a different frequency band. And it's like I was saying before, gravitational waves have their own frequency band. LIGO, ground-based observers, are going to be looking in the kilohertz regime. Pulsar timing is looking in the nanohertz regime. There are space-based possible gravitational wave detectors planned, like LISA, that's going to look in between those regimes in the millihertz. And basically, as we start filling this up, we've got our own spectrum, basically. It's a totally new astronomy. We are going to have just a different window to look at the universe. And I think to answer your question vaguely, and it's vague because of the excitement of not knowing what we'll see, but we will see things. There's going to be very exciting signals and very exciting science in there.
Yeah, great. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, no, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for that, Chris. Now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those other things we can't fit in anywhere else. It's the odds and ends. Megan, what have you got for us this time?
So my odd and end is M82. M82 is my favourite galaxy. I spent a considerable part of my PhD studying it. And last week, something went bang in M82. Which is kind of cool, because we've been waiting a long time for something to go bang in M82. And then we've had three in the last 5 years now, which is quite impressive. There was one in 2008. There was a supernova, 2008 IZ, which exploded. That was a core collapse supernova, so a very, very massive star that got to the end of its life, ran out of fuel, and exploded. And while we were looking at that in the radio, we found something else that started to get bright, and at the moment we still don't know what it is, because while supernovae get bright and then fade, this thing went bright and is still bright. It's not really faded away again yet, several years later. So we don't know what it is. We keep looking at it, and it's still there, but we know what it is. And then, last week, some students at University College London were doing a telescope session with one of the staff down there, and they looked at M82. And when they looked at their image, they went, "Ooh, that looks a bit different." They compared it to an old image, and they discovered a supernova. And since it was discovered, there have been many, many, many other telescopes have gone and looked at it, partly because it's the closest example of a particular type of supernova that we've seen for the last 40-odd years. So pretty much everybody's been looking at it with optical telescopes, X-ray telescopes, gamma-ray telescopes, pretty much everything, and most of the radio telescopes on the planet that can see it have been pointing at it as well.
M82 is a very dusty galaxy. How easy is it for optical telescopes to see this thing, just because dust tends to absorb a lot of optical light?
Yeah, that's right. M82 is a starburst galaxy. There's been a huge amount of star formation in it. It's also edge-on, which is a problem, because you're looking through the disk of a galaxy, basically. You've got the longest line of sight through stuff that you could possibly have, which means that an awful lot of things you're just never going to see because they're behind the dust. And that's one reason that we like looking at galaxies like this with radio telescopes, because radio telescopes can see through all of that dust. So these guys were quite lucky. This supernova appears to have been on the near side of M82. Which meant that it wasn't that obscure. There's some obscuration there. There's some dust in the way that you can see when you look at the spectrum. But it's fairly near to us on this side of the galaxy. And M82 itself is not really that far away in cosmic terms. It's only 3.5 megaparsecs, about 11 million light years. It's not really that far away. And this type of supernova is a type 1A, which is caused by a thermonuclear explosion on the surface of a white dwarf. And there are different models as to how this explosion actually happens. And the fact that this one is so close means that all of the observations that we can do in a lot of detail. And we can actually hopefully distinguish between those models. That's why it's exciting.
One of the other important things about the supernova in M82, too, is that we can measure the distance to M82 and the group of galaxies that M82 lives in, which is called the MA1 group, because the biggest galaxy in the group is MA1. We can actually measure distance to this group of galaxies using other means, such as looking at variable stars such as Cepheids, where we think we know what the brightness is based on looking at the Cepheids in our own galaxy. Astronomers have been able to use the HST to identify Cepheids in MA1, for example, and by comparing the brightnesses of the Cepheids in our own galaxy to MA1, can measure a distance there. MA1 is like a next-door neighbor to MA2, so if we know the distance to MA1, we just about know the distance to MA2, therefore we know the distance to a supernova as well. And as long as we can correct for the dust extinction, we know how bright the supernova should be at this distance. And then when we start looking at these really, really far away supernovae, we know how bright they should be as well.
Well, exactly. Another reason this is so exciting is because type 1A supernovae are kind of supernova that you study to work out how fast the universe is expanding. So you look at them in the distant universe, and you know how bright they actually are because they're all the same brightness. So if you measure how bright they appear, you can work out how far away they are, And this is what's one of the things that's led to actually the discovery that the universe is expanding faster and faster. It's accelerating. So if we can understand a nearby one in huge amounts of detail, then it actually helps a lot with those cosmological estimates.
That's really cool. How easy would it be for our average listener or, say, a member of the public to actually spot this this new supernova in M82?
If you have a reasonable-sized telescope, M82 is it's a Messier object, so it's easily viewable in an ordinary telescope. I think it peaked at about magnitude 10 or 11, something around that. So if you've got a reasonable-sized telescope, yeah, an amateur should be able to pick it up. And I've seen many, many really good photographs of M82 taken over the last 2 weeks by amateur astronomers with reasonable kit. So it's definitely doable, yeah.
Brilliant.
Well, I have something which vaguely relates to research I've done as well. This is an announcement from the Herschel Space Observatory. Now, the Herschel Space Observatory stopped operating in the spring of last year when it ran out of coolant to keep its infrared instruments cool, and so the telescope warmed up and the instruments could no longer see anything in space. Even though the telescope stopped working, astronomers are still working on the data from the telescope because it produced a huge amount of data. And recently, a group led by Michael Coopers announced that they had detected the presence of water vapor around the dwarf planet Ceres, which is also known to some people who don't like the dwarf planet designation as the first asteroid ever discovered. Now, this was kind of an interesting result in that nobody expected this. Ceres orbits the Sun roughly between Mars and Jupiter in the asteroid belt. Ice has been detected around the moons, around the gas giants, and has been detected from comets and other objects which are located like much further away in the solar system. This was just a very interesting result to see water vapor around Ceres. And the way the water vapor was detected was kind of interesting. Now, the Herschel Space Observatory doesn't produce very sharp images, so when it looks at Ceres, it looks like a smudge, basically. Just like a lot of other things, like stars just sort of look like fuzzy blobs, and very, very distant galaxies look like fuzzy blobs, although nearby galaxies look very pretty. So they couldn't image the water vapor on the dwarf planet. Instead, they detected the water vapor through an infrared spectral signature. They basically saw light being absorbed by the water vapor at some infrared wavelengths, which clearly indicated that it was there. They also found that there was a 9-hour variation in the appearance of this water vapor in the spectrum from the dwarf planet, which seemed to indicate that water vapor was being vented by a couple of specific locations on the surface of the dwarf planet. I guess I personally find this very interesting because it's I worked with trying to flux calibrate the Herschel Space Observatory, and Ceres was one of the objects that we had looked at for calibration, and I think we decided early on that we weren't going to try with Ceres. We had problems with one of the asteroids, so and it may be possible that this water vapor affects the calibration, or would affect our ability to use these objects to calibrate the telescope.
So Ceres has water vapor around it, or is venting water vapor, but does it have anything even close to an atmosphere, or is it just way too small to retain any kind of other gases?
I think it's close to too small and too hot as well to really retain much of an atmosphere. So most of this water vapor will just vent out into space. If you look at some of the other similar-sized bodies in the solar system, so Titan is close to roughly the same size, maybe larger. That has an atmosphere, but on the other hand, that's much colder.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Galilean satellites, the four largest moons of Jupiter, they don't have atmospheres. One of them has an icy mantle, but that's kind of different.
Sure.
Actually, three of them have icy mantles, but that's different. And Io, the fourth one, is actually perpetually squeezed by Jupiter and vents out material, which then flows into the magnetosphere of Jupiter. It doesn't actually stay gravitationally bound.
Interesting. My odd end has absolutely nothing to do with my research, as opposed to the first two. I'm just going to talk about a paper that Stephen Hawking published online recently. which isn't peer-reviewed, but which suggests some very interesting things about black holes. Now, as most of our listeners probably know, Stephen Hawking is kind of a bit of an expert in the matter, and he's most people's first idea of a physicist when they think about black holes. He's now suggested that there's no such thing as a black hole as we, as scientists, envision it today. So a black hole is essentially defined as an extremely dense point in space, which has an event horizon, which is a radius around this point beyond which light can't escape because of the gravitational pull of this extremely dense singularity. Recently, so the past couple of years, quantum theorists have actually postulated that due to principles of quantum mechanics, when stuff gets sucked into a black hole, classical theory says that information gets lost forever. Like, it gets sucked into the black hole and it never comes back out again. Quantum mechanics doesn't like it when you say that information just disappears.
So what do you mean by information?
Basically, this means particles. So you have electrons, protons, other smaller particles that, according to quantum mechanics, pop in and out of existence very rapidly and annihilate each other. And what happens is that if these appear next to a black hole and they get sucked into the event horizon, then these particles are supposedly lost forever. And that's sort of, so in quantum jargon, that means you take information out of the universe.
So, for example, you lose charge in the universe.
Exactly.
Or you lose electron count, for example. Or like, the term would actually be lepton count, because you sort of, like, count up all of the electrons and neutrinos, and that's supposed to be constant in the universe.
Exactly. These quantum theorists posited that when this happened, when some information got sucked into the black hole, you'd have to essentially release a large amount of energy to make up for this loss of information, and so the energy would get released back into the universe, and that would even things out essentially. But what that implied is that at the event horizon of the black hole, where the stuff gets lost, this outburst of energy would create a sort of firewall around the black hole, this really energetic area. In classical mechanics, or in general relativity, which governs the behavior of black holes, the thought experiment where you think about what would happen to an astronaut getting sucked into a black hole, and usually, according to Einstein, he would sort of wouldn't notice going past the event horizon because nothing would really change in the universe around him, but then he would slowly accelerate more and more towards a black hole, and eventually, once he or she was close enough, would just start getting ripped apart from head to toe because the gravity, the attraction at his feet would be much stronger than the one at his head, assuming he's falling feet first, obviously. And he'd be sort of pulled into little strands. And it's quite, physicists have quite an imagination for this sort of thought experiment.
Spaghettification, though. It's great when you talk to kids about this kind of thing. They love spaghettification, especially when you demonstrate with a stuffed toy.
But what would happen, according to the quantum theorists, is that way before the spaghettification started, the astronaut would just run into the firewall and die a fiery, horrible death instead. Answers on a postcard to which one you think is worse. But this illustrates a fundamental discrepancy between general relativity, or Einstein's theories, which say that gravity should act the same and have the same principles at every point in the universe, and quantum mechanics, which clearly says that the event horizon is special because you will have this firewall of energy that surrounds the black hole. So Stephen Hawking has proposed a solution to this discrepancy that keeps quantum mechanics and general relativity intact. He proposes that black holes actually don't have a classical event horizon which could catch fire, as it were. Hawking talks about an apparent horizon as opposed to an event horizon, which is a surface along which light rays will stop in space. They'll be suspended. They won't be able to go any further than that. And with a normal sort of classical unchanging black hole, the event horizon and the apparent horizon are essentially the same thing. That's where the light rays stop, and that's where they can't go any further. The black hole grows by absorbing more matter. The event horizon will surpass the apparent horizon, so light rays will be able to go past it, but will still get stopped by the event horizon. On the other hand, if black holes can shrink, which is something that Hawking posited in the 1970s through Hawking radiation, which is where particles appearing right at the boundary of the event horizon would release radiation into space and would release antimatter back into the black hole, effectively shrinking it. And if the black hole shrinks so much that it goes past the apparent horizon, effectively light would be able to escape once again, so the information wouldn't be permanently lost in the black hole. So what this means is that there wouldn't be a singularity at the centre of the black hole, there wouldn't be an area of infinite density of infinite space, only a place where matter would be temporarily held back by all the gravitational potential. And if the black hole shrank enough, then this matter could then be released back into space. And the matter itself would be very transformed. I mean, it wouldn't be in the same sort of state that it was when it got in because of all the crazy gravitational pressure inside the black hole, but it would still get back out in space nonetheless. For the moment, this is an extremely untested theory. It's just almost a wild proposition, and the only reason that it's got a lot of traction is because it's been emitted by Stephen Hawking. However, there is still a need to resolve the paradox created by this discovery of the quantum firewall around black holes, and the jury's still out as to how we reconcile these two now apparently very conflicting theories, which are quantum mechanics and general relativity.
It's all really fun stuff, but it's the kind of thing that you can only really test by theory. You can't actually go and visit a black hole and see what's actually happening, because they're all, well, the nearest one is in the middle of our galaxy, which is still 8 kiloparsecs away. So difficult to test any of these things, isn't it?
No, absolutely. We can't really chuck a willing sacrifice down the black hole yet to see whether they burst into flames or get turned into spaghetti, but...
This also is very abstract stuff, so it's like when you first read the Stephen Hawking's press release, it sort of sounds sort of crazy, but when you actually sit and read through or listen to the description, it actually sounds like a rational, although very abstract, theoretical issue that needs to be addressed in physics.
This is one of the subjects that is definitely prone to sensationalizing by the media, and where big headlines will be that, you know, Hawking claims that black holes don't exist, and when it's not quite what he's saying.
Stephen Hawking is also somebody who's going to be heavily sensationalized too. After all, how many physicists have appeared on Star Trek?
Well, public health warning here, we would not recommend that you actually go and try and fall into a black hole to find out what happens, because of course we can't guarantee your safety.
And moving on now to talk about something that we're absolutely certain does exist, here's Ian Morrison with the Northern Night Sky.
The night sky for February 2014. Well, we have a lovely sky after sunset during this month. That great constellation of Orion the Hunter is now a little bit to the west of south. The three stars of its belt point upwards towards Taurus the Bull, with those two lovely clusters, the Hyades with the interloper Aldebaran and the Pleiades. Up to the left of Orion, we have Gemini, the heavenly twins, and that this month contains the planet Jupiter. And going down leftwards from the three stars of the belt, we come to Sirius, the dog star, Alpha Canis Majoris. Sadly, for those of us in the north of England, the lower parts of Canis Major are not very obvious. But one thing you can try with a small telescope is just to scan downwards from Sirius, a little bit to the left, and you should come across a rather lovely little open cluster called M41. It's my favourite open cluster, actually, partly because not many people ever look at it, but there's a lovely red giant star in the centre amongst all the blue stars, the hot blue stars. It makes a lovely contrast. Moving over to the left, towards the south and then the southeast, we have Canis Minor with the bright star Procyon. And then we come through Cancer with M44, the beehive cluster, well seen with binoculars. And then rising over in the east, we have Leo the Lion, its brightest star being Regulus. It's a bit like the lions in Trafalgar Square on their haunches. Following Leo, but rising later in the night, is that region of the sky called the Realm of the Galaxies, between Leo and Virgo, looking towards the giant Virgo cluster of galaxies. Higher up in the northeast, we have Ursa Majoris. Above Taurus, we have the bright yellow star Capella in Auriga. And then we have, over towards the northwest, Cassiopeia and Perseus. If you follow from Cassiopeia towards Perseus, you're running along the plane of the Milky Way. And there's a lovely object there. It's called the double cluster in Perseus. A little hazy glow in binoculars. Well, what about the planets? Well, it's pretty obvious that the star in the planets this month is Jupiter. It's well placed in the evening sky, in the latter part of what is really an excellent apparition. It shines at magnitude minus 2.6. It actually was at opposition, i.e. due south around midnight, on Jan the 5th. So at the start of the month, it's high in the sky during the evening, being at 40 degrees elevation by 7 p.m. and rising to an elevation of over 60 degrees in the south around 10 p.m. It honestly doesn't get better than this. By month's end, Jupiter will be due south about 8:30 p.m. As I said earlier, it's lying in the constellation Gemini, moving westwards in retrograde motion towards the star Mebsuta, Epsilon Geminorum. With a small telescope, you can observe the four Gallian moons as they weave their way around it, and at times be able to pick out the great red spot, visible as an indentation in the south equatorial belt. Well, what about Saturn? It's a morning object, now visible in the pre-dawn sky, rising about 2 a.m. at the start of the month and about 12:30 at its end. It's lying in Libra, shining with a magnitude of plus 0.4, so it's not that bright. Its disk has a diameter of 17 arc seconds. The really good news is that the rings, with a diameter of 38 arc seconds, have now opened out to around 23 degrees from the line of sight, so presenting a magnificent view. With a small telescope, one should be able to spot Cassini's division that lies between the A and the B rings. If you have a telescope of perhaps 200 millimetres in aperture, the Encke gap towards the edge of ring A might be seen when the seeing is good. Sadly, for those of us in the northern hemisphere, Saturn is now lying in the more southerly part of the ecliptic, so even at opposition, its elevation does not get that high. And even worse, this situation will not improve for many years to come. Well, Mars is now moving on in its apparition. It lies in Virgo and rises about 11:30 at the start of the month, about 1 hour earlier by month's end. Its magnitude is increasing from plus 0.2 to minus 0.5 during the month, as the angular size increases from 9 to 11 arc seconds. So, given good seeing, it should be possible to see markings on its salmon-pink surface, which is 91% illuminated. These could be Syrtis Major, a V-shaped dark feature, or the polar caps, although it's actually the summer for the North Polar Cap, which is actually the one that's sort of facing towards us, so it may not be that prominent. Mars is moving down across Virgo, and at the start of the month is just 5 degrees to the upper left of Spica, Alpha Virginis. It ends the month 6 degrees to the left of Spica, as it then begins its retrograde motion back across the sky. Mercury. Mercury reached its greatest elongation east, that is, furthest in angular separation to the left of the Sun, of 18 degrees on Jan the 31st, when it lay about 10 degrees above the horizon, 45 minutes after sunset, lying near a very slender crescent moon. On the 1st of February, it will lie about 8 degrees below a slightly fuller crescent moon. The magnitude will then be minus 0.6. It will have an angular size of 7 arc seconds. And, given the low western horizon, should be visible for about 2 hours after sunset. Moving back towards the sun in angle, it will still remain visible for about an hour and a half after sunset by February the 7th. But by then its brightness will have dropped to magnitude plus 1. The angular size of the 20% illuminated disk will then increase slightly to 8 arc seconds. But then rapidly disappears from view, passing in front of the Sun, that's called inferior conjunction, on the 15th of February. But by month's end, it will reappear again in the pre-dawn sky. It's actually then about 20 degrees to the west of the Sun, but the elevation will be very low, and with a magnitude of plus 1, it will not be easy to spot. Well, finally, Venus. Well, Venus passed between the Earth and the Sun on the 11th of January, so in February will be seen low above the eastern horizon before dawn. By mid-February, the planet, shining at magnitude minus 4.6, will be visible 17 degrees above the southeastern horizon at sunrise. On Valentine's Day, it will show a 25% illuminated crescent disk, some 41 arc seconds across. As February draws to a close, Venus, remaining at magnitude minus 4.6, presents a fuller disk rising to 36%, that will be about 33 arc seconds across. Well, what about the highlights of the month? Well, as I've implied, February is a superb month to view Jupiter in the evening. A small telescope will see lots of details. Surely, if you haven't got one yet, you should get one. It's looking a little bit different than some of the last few years, as the North Equatorial Belt has become quite broad. The Great Red Spot has become more prominent recently and can be easily seen in a large feature in the South Equatorial Belt. If you look at the highlights for the month in the night sky page on the Jodrell Bank website, I've given a diagram based upon an image I took December 2012 showing you the main features, but also I give a list of when the Great Red Spot is visible at suitable times during the evening. I've mentioned that on February the 1st and 2nd, Mercury will be close to a thin crescent moon. A nice thing to try and do when there's a very thin crescent is to look for Earthshine, the dark side of the moon illuminated by light reflected by clouds on Earth. On February the 10th, after sunset, Jupiter will be seen close to a waxing moon. It's about 7 degrees away. On February the 19th, before dawn, Mars will be close, about 5.5 degrees above Spica in Virgo, and 10 degrees to the upper right of a waning moon. Perhaps a nice thing to look for is on the 22nd of February, and plus or minus a few days, in fact, try and spot the second largest of the asteroids, its Pallas, or Minor Planet 2. This month, it's moving northwards through Hydra, closing in on the second magnitude star, Alphard, A-L-P-H-A-R-D. On the 22nd of the month, it reaches opposition, and so will be due south around midnight, shining at magnitude plus 7, sadly not visible with the unaided eye, but easily visible in a pair of binoculars. And that night, it'll be just 4 degrees away from Alphard. So if you find that, you can see Pallas in the same field of view of a pair of binoculars. Pallas is the second largest minor planet after Ceres in the main asteroid belt, and is about 550 kilometers across. On the 22nd, it'll be just over twice as far from the Sun as the Earth, 2.1 astronomical units. And perhaps I could point out, should the diameter of an object be greater than about 800 kilometers, then gravity will make it spherical. And nowadays, it would then be classed as a dwarf planet. And that is, in fact, the case with Ceres. Finally, on February the 26th, before dawn, Venus is very close to a thin crescent moon. Looking southeast before dawn on that morning, you should spot Venus just half a degree above the disk of a slender waning crescent moon. And that should make a very good astrophotography target. Anyway, enjoy the months observing the sky.
Thanks for that, Ian. And for our listeners on the other side of the equator, here's John Field with the Southern Night Sky.
Kia ora, and welcome to the February Dodcast from Carter Observatory. Our evening sky is dominated by the planet Jupiter, along with the constellations of Orion, Canis Major, and Taurus in our northern sky. Appearing as a bright white star, Jupiter continues to move in front of the distant stars that form the zodiac constellation of Gemini the Twins. Gemini is one of the constellations through which the ecliptic passes. Over the year, the Sun moves in front of these constellations as the Earth completes its annual orbit around it. To the left of Jupiter and Gemini is an upside-down V of stars that forms the head of another zodiac constellation, Taurus the Bull. The brightest star in the V is Aldebaran, which has a distinct orange hue. This star is about 65 light-years away and is similar in mass to Sirius, but has evolved to become a giant star. As the star expanded, its surface area also increased, and its surface temperature dropped, giving the star an orangey-red hue. Sirius and our Sun will eventually do this, but not for a very long time. The fainter stars of the V belong to a more distant cluster called the Hyades. These are younger and brighter stars than Aldebaran. By extending the V down towards the northern horizon, you will find two stars marking the horn tips. The Pleiades mark the bull's back and can be found to the west of his head. Visible as a compact cluster of at least six stars, they make a fine sight in binoculars. In Greek mythology, Taurus is seen as the embodiment of the great god Zeus. Gemini and Cancer are two of the other zodiac constellations in our summer sky. The bright stars Castor and Pollux mark the heads of the twins, and they can be found in the north after sunset below Jupiter. Gemini lies on the eastern edge of the Milky Way, and this region contains a number of faint and distant stars. Within 1 degree of Castor, there are 5 faint galaxies that can be found using a large telescope. The December radiant of the Gemini meteor shower is also near to this star. Pollux, the brighter of the two stars, is about 35 light years away from us. Nearby to Eta Geminorum, marking one of the feet of Gemini, is M35, an open star cluster. Under good conditions, it can be viewed with the unaided eye as a hazy star. Binoculars or a wide field telescope are the best way to view this lovely cluster. Cancer the Crab is a fainter constellation of 5 stars, and near to the center is a naked eye cluster of stars called the Praesepe, or the Beehive. This large and bright star cluster appears as a nebula to the unaided eye, and binoculars reveal individual stars. Galileo viewed this cluster with his telescope in 1610, being the first human to see it as a star cluster. Orion the Hunter, our summer constellation, is due north after sunset. This bright grouping of stars dominates our summer evening sky, and to us southern hemisphere observers, hangs upside down. Orion's brightest stars, Rigel, Betelgeuse, and Bellatrix, along with the 3 stars of his belt, form an easily seen pattern in our evening sky. Well, place viewing is the Orion Nebula, which can be found in the middle of Orion's sword. To the unaided eye, this nebula appears as a fuzzy star. If you have binoculars or a small telescope, they will reveal a bat-shaped cloud. A 100mm or greater telescope will reveal a number of stars in and around the nebula, including a tight group of 4 stars called the trapezium. Above the belt of Rigel, the brightest star in Orion, although it is listed as Beta, the second brightest star. This star is actually a triple star system about 860 light years away, and the total luminosity of the group is estimated to be 130,000 times that of our Sun. To the east are Orion's 2 hunting companions, Canis Major, the large, and below, Canis Minor, the smaller dog. The brightest star in our night sky, Sirius, marks the collar of Canis Major. For us, the dog is lying on his back with his feet up in the air. Sirius is 8.7 light years away, and about 26 times brighter than our Sun. Below Canis Major is Procyon, the 8th brightest star in the night sky. Just over a third of the way between Sirius and Procyon is a cluster of stars called M50, visible in binoculars. About halfway along the line from Procyon to Betelgeuse, binoculars will reveal a rectangular cluster of stars that is embedded in a faint nebula, called the Rosette. Almost overhead in the early evening sky is the second brightest star, Canopus. From midnight, Mars, followed by Saturn, can be found rising in the east. Mars is in Virgo, and Saturn is in the constellation of Libra. Our autumn and winter months will see Mars and Saturn in our evening sky and better placed for viewing. Finally, Venus will reappear in our morning sky, rising just before the Sun. It will climb higher as the month progresses, and at month end, it will be joined by Mercury. We hope you have clear skies during the summer nights and take the opportunity to view the lights of our southern skies.
Thank you for that, John. And now it's time for feedback.
I'm sorry to report that this time we haven't got any post, and the email inbox is sitting a bit bare. Thanks to all the new people who have liked our page on Facebook.
We've also had a few things on Twitter since the last show. We've had a couple of ex-Jodcasters, or Jodcasters Emeritus, as we like to call them, who've got in touch recently, one of them being Jen Gupta, who pointed out that a show had already been called Llama, so we've now amended that on the January Extra show, so thanks for that, Jen. And Liz Guzman also tweeted at us to say, "So happy to be back in the Jodcast, an interview about my job at Alma." And of course you can check out Liz's interview on the last Jodcast by going to jodcast.net/archive.
And as usual, thanks to all our new likers on Facebook, and for all the retweets, and follow Fridays on Twitter. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/group/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can also send us real post. The address is on the website.
Thanks to Dr. Chris Messenger for the interview. The editors were Sally Cooper, Indy LeClerc, and Mark Perver. The producer was Sally Cooper. Until next time,
Jod on!